Good morning. Good morning, everyone. These journal cover, I just barely get them all together. I want to thank ChatGPT, which helped me big time. Otherwise, I don't think I can accomplish getting everything done. I think this month is pretty exciting. We have many interesting articles. So before we dive deep into the selected articles, I want to just briefly mention some articles for notations and reviews. I think they are all pretty excellent articles. So there was one talking about primary salivary duct carcinoma, only 5 cases, but basically doing the same thing as you would expect for primary salivary gland, salivary duct carcinoma. The same morphology, the same immunophenotype. And another paper talking about BEP1 in further can subclassify the mesothelioma patients. So the BEP1, they found BEP1 deficiency can correlate with better immunotherapy. So for better stratification for treatment for patient, maybe BEP1 deficient mesothelioma patient can better respond to immunotherapy. Then there's three articles from GTO talking about TNM systems, because the next edition of the TNM staging will be coming up, and they are discussing whether the current TNM is reasonable or whether we should change it. So for the T stage, will remain the same. The eighth edition, the ninth edition, will looks very similar to the eighth edition. And for the N descriptor, they are proposing that maybe for the N2 stage can be further subsplitted into N2A and the N2B. So N2A represent a single station metastasis in the N2 lymph nodes, whereas N2B will be multiple station involvement in the N2 lymph nodes. So that could be a change in the new TNM staging system. And for the M description, mainly the same, but for the M1C category. So right now, M1C category is multiple extrathoracic metastasis in single organ system or multiple organ systems. But in here, they are saying based on the prognosis, maybe the M1C can be further divided into M1C1 and M1C2, depending on whether it's single extrathoracic organ system or multiple extrathoracic organ system is involved. I thought those are interesting. For non-neoplastic articles, it's really a very exciting month for the Journal of American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. In that journal, basically, the whole journal is a special issue for interstitial lung disease. So I thought there's so much biology that I have never been aware of, which has been talked about in this journal. For example, for sarcoidosis, in this particular article, it's arguing for aberrant lipid metabolism in macrophages is a crucial factor in granuloma formation in sarcoidosis. So perhaps the cholesterol-lowering treatments, such as statins, could be helpful in reduced granuloma formation in sarcoidosis. And another article is about AI or deep learning classification model in recognizing UIP in CT scans. So in this particular article, it's actually arguing the AI algorithm actually doing a better job surpass the radiologists in recognizing a UIP pattern. Also, for each of these research articles, there's also editorial articles. To comment on the research articles, I also list in below the article. Another paper is about
Could I ask a question? Sorry, it's Margaret here. So the aberrant lipid metabolism in macrophages, was that on formalin-fixed macrophages or was it fresh macrophages like in BAL or something?
Oh, very good question. I have to confess, I didn't dive into all these articles. So for me, very shallow reading of all these articles for notations. So good
Okay.
question. I don't know the answer for that. Okay. Continue. There's also a proteomic biomarker analysis in correlating with the survival in IPF patients, and this is a paper actually done from University of Michigan. So in here they identified 140 protein biomarkers associated with prognosis in transplant transplant-free survival in IPF patients. And there's another article also done from University of Michigan. It's about analysis of the microbial diversity using the buccal swabs in correlating with the severity of IPF patients. So they found lower microbial diversity and higher Streptococcus abundance in the oral microbiome are linked to preserved lung function and reduced mortality in IPF patients. So I thought that's also very interesting. Regarding review articles, there's a quite nice review articles of molecular and ancillary and immunohistochemical ancillary studies on mesothelioma published in archives. I thought it's pretty good review article. And then there's another review article is about pathological assessment and staging for multiple non-small cell lung cancer. So whether how do you distinguish intrapulmonary metastasis or synchronous primaries? We had that discussion in last month's journal club, and in here this is a review article saying that very broad panel of NGS can be very helpful in answering these questions. And there's two articles is about regarding stats. So there's a con argument saying stats probably is an artifact, and there's another pro argument saying stats is a real phenomenon. I'm not a big fan of stats, but and also I think it's reflecting that in the field it's still kind of like controversial. But I guess we have to do whatever WHO and the CAP protocol asks us to do. So just a quick summary. This table is a quick summary I did. So in these two articles, so you can see in the con argument, there are 6 pages. In the pro argument, there's 21 pages. Very much longer paper in the pro argument, which is from Dr. Travis, who invented this term. And in terms of reference, in the pro articles, there are many more references than the con articles. I just thought it's interesting statistics. And there's another editorial I thought it's interesting. It's asking whether we should move our TNM staging beyond just anatomic descriptors. So, like in the GYN field, they upstage, they change the FIGO grading, not only about the TNM, they also add in whether there's a lymphovascular invasion. If there's lymphovascular invasion, how much is there is, like focal or multiple or diffuse, and also molecular data. So it's kind of like an integration of all the other parameters to give a final staging. So, I think in here in this paper, it's asking whether the lung field should move beyond the anatomic descriptor. Should we also add in the molecular findings to give a final stage? Meaning, if the patient has a bad molecular alteration, we probably should upstage the patient. So, this is just a thought. But in the GYN field, this already moved into print out, upstage the FIGO grading system. I feel like the math really hard to grade it as a pathologist by taking into all the information. And for the correspondence and case reports, I really like this case report. This case report is a case report of vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's something we don't think about too often, but I think it's kind of interesting if I can show you the paper here. You can see the paper. Can you see the paper? Yeah, okay. So basically, you see this kind of ossification associated with a little bit sickle cell organizing pneumonia. So I think it's good to remember this histology to think about underlying Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So I like this case report quite a bit. So after that, I think we can dive into the article for discussion. So the first article I think I want to discuss today is from our Mayo Clinic colleagues. It's about prognostic immunohistochemistry for Ki-67 and OTP on small biopsies of pulmonary carcinoid tumors. So basically, all the studies are done on either small biopsy or cytology specimen, and the biomarker used are Ki-67 and the OTP. So I think this is very a useful study because for patients who are not surgical candidates were treated with tumor ablation with no tissue available for further analysis, the only tissue that you can use to extrapolate the prognostic data will be the small biopsy or cytology specimen. So it's good to know how to stratify the patient in terms of prognosis. So I think that's a very interesting and helpful study. So in terms of methods in this study, so there the study includes 139 small biopsies. Total numbers 139 small biopsies, so it's collected from 1996 to 2022. And in here, the Ki labeling index was measured using some kind of automated image analysis through a Puro ImageScope software by analyzing at least 500 cells using at least 10 small 0.11 millimeter square boxes at the hotspot, which is selected by a technologist. And 10% of cases were reviewed by a real pathologist for concordance. And the OTPHC is analyzed not on all the cases, but on 70 cases. And the negativity is defined by less than 20% of tumor cells staining with OTP. And the clinical data was extrapolated and correlated with disease-specific progression-free survival. So in here, you can look at, so total we have 139 cases, and among these 139 cases, most of them are biopsy specimens, and there's some cytology specimen. Let's see. Oh, so I thought this is interesting. So you'll think carcinoid tumor, most of them should be treated with resection. That's why on biopsy or cytology specimen, we don't specify typical or atypical carcinoid tumor. We just call it carcinoid tumor. And most of patients will be followed by resection as a treatment. But in here, I thought it's interesting that up to 25% of this cohort, the patient didn't underwent a surgical management. And in this cohort, in terms of the histologic classification, there are 81% typical carcinoid. So this cohort is overpowered by typical carcinoid tumor, which is true for any carcinoid tumor research studies, because we just see way more typical carcinoid tumors in the lung than atypical carcinoid tumors. So overall, I think there's for the cases that does not present with metastasis in the during the initial biopsy, in that group of patients, there are 10 progressed has progressed in later, including six distant metastasis to the liver, bone, eye, and also two regional lymph node metastasis and two local recurrences. So for these 10 cases, I wasn't sure. Which I didn't extrapolate from the paper, whether these 10 cases are all atypical carcinoid tumor, whether they all have higher Ki-67, which is something I didn't extrapolate from the paper. Maybe our Mayo Clinic colleagues can tell us more details on that. So I want to show you. So in here, I want to show you. So this is a picture to show you that's how they did it, the Ki-67 counting. So they used some kind of like automated imaging software, and the pathology found the hot spot. Then the software will put these boxes, 10 or more than 10 boxes, to reach 500 cells. And then within the 10 box, each boxes, and the software will analyze it. So blue meaning negative cells, and red meaning Ki-67 positive cells, and I think yellow means weak positivity. So they're using this software to count their Ki-67 labeling index. And this is a picture to show an example of OTP expression. So further, you can see in here that the hazard ratio for progression increase when the Ki-67 index increases, but it's pretty much leveled when it's reached to 4 to 5% in here. And in here, you can also see that Ki-67 as 3%. 4%, they both have a similar good correlation with progression. So can separate the patients based on progression using 3% or 4% Ki-67 labeling index. And the physiologic subclassification into typical and atypical carcinoid tumor also does a good job in separating the patients in terms of progression of disease and showing in this figure. So for the following study, because 3% of and 4% they are showing similar in terms of disease progression. So the paper focused on 3% because in the GI system, 3% was used in their neuroendocrine tumor classification. So for a harmonized scheme, 3% was used for the following analysis.
Can I ask a question? Because it isn't clear to me from those figures. I mean, number one, it shows what other papers have shown in that histology outperforms Ki-67 in terms of statistical significance of the separation. But previous studies have shown that the value of Ki-67 might be in typical carcinoid tumors. Like that might be where you can get separation based on Ki-67, although Marshevsky and Farber both used 5% rather than 3%. So is that data in this paper? Like what does it look like in the set of carcinoid tumors, typical carcinoid tumors, if you use Ki-67?
So yeah, this so you in here you in, so in the because in biopsy with small cytology, we don't separate into typical versus atypical, right? So but there's a 75% of the cohort study they have resection, right? So based on resection, it can be further classified into atypical or typical carcinoid tumor. So you can see in this figure in the resection specimen for the cases classified as typical carcinoid tumor, you can see the Ki labeling index is a pretty wide range on the biopsy. It's ranging from really low to pretty high, and overlapping with the Ki-67 labeling index for the atypical carcinoid tumor, even though the mean, you can tell the difference of the
So
mean Ki-67.
that's kind of the point. So if you plot out event-free survival for typical carcinoids, separating them into those that have less than or equal to a Ki-67 proliferation index of 3% and those with higher, what does that look like? That's the question. Be because previous authors have suggested that maybe grade 1 and grade 2 NET both live in the typical carcinoid category, potentially. But we don't have that data from this paper. Is it doesn't look like.
I don't think so. And do our Mayo Clinic colleagues can answer that question? If not, I just
Sorry. Yeah. Jen was the lead, so she would have more knowledge. But the point was on needle biopsy. So that's really where the point was that since we don't separate typical versus atypical on a needle te technically, was that using K67, could we predict outcome? And that was, or at least predict which ones would be more at risk of being atypical, and also predicting which ones would progress beyond being just calling it atypical. So to answer Tao's question earlier, so the patients that had shown progression and metastasis, those are the ones that typically had a K67 above 4%, and the higher the K67, more of them had progression or metastasis. So there was a link there. So it's not in replacement of typical versus atypical, it's as an addition to atypical versus
Right,
atypical.
I get that. So maybe I misunderstood. So the Ki-67 assessment was only done on the biopsy in the 104 patients who underwent a resection, or did they get another Ki-67 proliferation index in the resection?
Oh.
No. The test only analyzed in the biopsy. That's the
The
purpose of this
biopsy.
study.
I got it. So it's hard to see the value in that, right? Because there's only one treatment response to the diagnosis of carcinoid, which is resection in more patients than not, right? Like, what would you do differently?
Because this cohort showed there's 25% of the patient in this cohort, they didn't underwent resection. So the only tissue the patient
But
had.
that's a biased experience, right? Most patients with a diagnosis of carcinoid tumor on a biopsy will get a resection.
Right.
And so there, okay, so it seems like the question is, does the biopsy Ki-67 proliferation index predict what it will be in the resection? Like that would be a relevant question, right?
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
yeah, true. But also, I think this graph also showing that you maybe you don't really care typical or atypical if the Ki-67 is also doing a same good job in separating the patients in terms of disease progression. So I thought that's kind of also interesting because also I think some old patients, if they never go to resection, then all you have is just small biopsy and cytology specimen. And if you can extrapolate the prognostic factors from those small biopsies and cytology, also very helpful, I think. So next, I think this figure also showing that if they use Ki-67 at 3.21%, that is regarded as the optimal threshold to predict a typical carcinoid versus a typical carcinoid with a sensitivity of 77% and specificity of 67%. I think that's pretty much about the Ki-67 role. And the OTP, I think, is didn't show really statistic significance in terms of associating like negative OTP staining is not statistically significant associated with shorter disease-specific progression-free survival or a typical carcinoid morphology or Ki-67 more than 3%. It may have that trending, but it's not statistically significant. So overall, I think this paper showing that Ki-67 IHC on small biopsy samples is available valuable prognostic tool for pulmonary carcinoid patients who cannot undergo resection, or sometimes they just do ablation, so there's just no tissue for you to analysis. I think in those scenarios, doing Ki-67 on small biopsy has its value. And 3% thresholds seem to be a predictive for disease-specific progression-free survival and a typical carcinoid histology. And I love the last paragraph was written in this paper saying that the funding contribute to a growing body of literature supporting the prognostic utility of Ki-67 for pulmonary carcinoid tumors and support movement toward harmonization of pulmonary carcinoid tumor classification with that used for well-differentiating neuroendocrine tumors of the GI tract and the pancreas. I also support a harmonized or unified approach for the neuroendocrine tumor above and below the diaphragm to reduce confusion. Any questions for this paper?
Hi, so I just want to ask about OTP. We don't use it. We don't have it in Calgary. Is it a useful a useful stain?
Good question. I think maybe our Mayo Clinic colleagues can help to answer that question because we don't use it in Michigan either.
It's actually useful to distinguish the neuroendocrine tumors of the lung from anywhere else. So it's really lung specific. It may not be 100% sensitive, but if it's positive, that really points towards lung. But that only works in the neuroendocrine tumors, not in the carcinomas, because there are neuroendocrine carcinomas elsewhere that can be positive. So yeah, it even works with the thymic neuroendocrine tumors. They are negative for OTP.
Oh, wow, that's
Yeah,
interesting.
it's pretty good for that.
Yeah.
Good to know that. Can I also ask you a question about the automated way to count Ki-67? Is that easy to use that software, or you have to do some customized manipulation of the software?
I don't know that. I haven't been involved
Oh,
with the
I see. No
technique.
problem. No problem. I thought so.
I
Interesting.
just made sure the Ki-67 works.
Yeah.
No, part of it is the K67 that we use in our DIA lab. That's what kind of we use routinely, and that was validated. But I don't know about the software. That was Jen and Julia that
I
kind
see.
of
I
put
see.
that together.
Got it. Yeah, I'm kind of interested. I'm using other software. It's not that accurate. Have to do some modified version of it. Yeah, so maybe I can ask Jean about that. It's a very interesting approach. So next paper is about molecular like deeper and broader molecular analysis for the large cell carcinoma of the lung. As you know, for large cell carcinoma of the lung, the molecular study is limited. So in this paper, they're trying to broaden our knowledge in the molecular alterations of large cell carcinoma. So in here, this is from Italy group, and they have collected 16 cases of large cell carcinoma between 2010 and 2020. They use both gene mutation analysis on 409 genes, and also they analyzed the transcriptome data of 20,815 genes. So based on this comprehensive molecular data, they also compared the transcriptomic profiling in comparison of the large cell carcinoma with 17 adenocarcinoma and 11 large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma for comparison. So based on this mutation analysis, you can see that so for the last of these 16 cases, the most common mutation is TP53 gene mutation, followed by RB1 gene mutation, followed by KEAP1 mutation, and also the CRKL, MIB-B and MIB-C amplification. Oh, yeah, amplification is also pretty common in this group of cases. And in terms of the, when they analyzed the transcription data, they found large cell carcinoma can be further subdivided into two kinds. One is they label as pure large cell carcinoma. The other one is called adenocarcinoma-like large cell carcinoma, because you can see based on the transcription data, they see a subset of large cell carcinoma have similar transcription data as adenocarcinoma, where there's the other set of large cell carcinoma is distinct from either adeno or large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So and in here, they so for the pure large cell carcinoma, is characterized by overexpression of POL2, F3, and FOXC1. Basically, it's a tough cell a phenotype. I want to show you the figure. So in here, this is a pure large cell carcinoma. It's showing overexpression of POL2, F3, and FOXC1. And this is a more like tough cell-like profile. And this group of patients, in this subgroup is correlated with DNA repair through a homologous recombination mechanism, including ATM and ATR pathways. And in the adenocarcinoma like large cell carcinoma, it does not express too much FOXC1 and POL2F3, but expressing a lot of AIM2. I don't know that marker, but that marker actually involves inflammatory complex signature. So meaning probably immunotherapy could be a good therapy for this group of large cell carcinoma. And they say using these three markers, you can further subclassify large cell carcinoma into two distinct transcription groups. But I think this is kind of interesting. If I see this and this kind of morphology, I'm wondering whether I would be thinking about large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. But based on the transcription data, this large cell carcinoma with this kind of subgroup is very distinct from large cell carcinoma. So basically, I think this paper just provide a more detailed a genetic analysis of this large cell carcinoma. And large cell carcinoma can be separated into two distinct groups. One group more look like a tough cell-like profile and involving in DNA repair pathways, whereas the other group of large cell carcinoma is more adenocarcinoma-like and involve more the inflammatory pathways. And knowing it in more like a detailed molecular alteration probably can help to better treat this patient, because there are some targeted therapy for the DNA repair pathways. So there's some specific ATR inhibitors. If we know the large cell carcinoma in that group, we can use that particular inhibitor to treat that large cell carcinoma. I thought that's interesting, because not much molecular data about large cell carcinoma, at least paper provide that detailed molecular changes for large cell carcinoma. Any questions about this one? Okay, so we'll move on to the third paper. The third paper, I think, is really an elegant paper. I mean, I think this is, to me, I think this is the way for the future. So this is talking about the prevalence and the therapeutic prevalence and therapeutic targeting of high level ERBB2 amplification in non-small cell lung cancer, basically HER2 amplification. I think this paper is talking about the underlying HER2 targeted therapy is really prevalent in many organ systems, like in the breast, in GI, and in the GYN ward. I mean, it's very good therapy, but in terms of in treating lung cancer, there's some kind of like a conflicting data and no good treatment. So this paper trying to address these questions. So trying to address the frequency and the therapeutic potential of high level or HER2 amplification in lung cancer, and trying to identify patients who can actually be beneficial from HER2 targeted therapies. So I thought this is really interesting. And this study is really comprehensive, also include a lot of like lab-related data, like in vitro and in vivo cell line and xenograft data to support their argument. So in this data, the study is extrapolate data from their database of 5,769 non-small cell samples. Then they use NGS sequencing data to extrapolate HER2 amplification, and they define HER2 amplification as more than 6 copies is HER2 amplified a case. So they didn't specify why they use 6 copies, but no other numbers. So they didn't specify that. And also, I think so in here they also tested the efficacy of three kinds of HER2 targeted drugs. One is called afatinib, which is a small molecule pan ERBB tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and there's an anti HER2 antibody therapy and HER2 antibody drug conjugates or ADCs. I don't know whether you are familiar with antibody drug conjugates. Basically, it have the HER2 antibody which can target the HER2 overexpression cells, and that antibody is conjugated with some drugs. So this is a very unique way to deliver the drug to the cells who have HER2 amplification. So they call the antibody drug conjugates. So they use this kind of three groups of drugs to test the their efficiency in treating lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer with HER2 amplification. And also in here, I think we also probably should be familiar with how to read the HER2 IHC, what is positive result, what is negative result. We sort of talked about in this HER2 assay in our last month's journal club also. So in here, that is how it's defined, positive or negative. So zero just absent, 1+ just very weak and barely visible thinning in at least 10% of cells, and 2+ is moderate circumferential or basal lateral staining in at least 10% of the tumor cells, and 3+ is strong circumferential or basal lateral in at least 10% of tumor cells. And the cases were regarded as negative when the score is 0 or 1, and regarded as positive when the HER2 IHC scores is 2+ and 3+. So here's a figure to show you that 3+ is really strong. This is 0, 1, and 2+. That's how the staining pattern for them to score the HER2 IHC, and 2+ and 3+ both are called positive, and negative is 0 and 1+. So in total in this cohort, through this search in their database, they found only 33 cases out of 3,079 cases, so represent 0.9% of lung cancer have a HER2 overexpression. And it's very interesting if you look at them like in more detailed molecular alterations, you can see it can be further separated into two groups. So group A, the HER2 amplification is the sole driver mutation in this group of patients. And these patients seem to be more likely to be male patients with a more heavy smoking history. And also in this group of patients, they have higher tumor mutation burden. And in group B, basically, they not only have HER2 amplification, they also, this group of patients also have concurrent other oncogenic driver mutations. And in group B, like for the subgroup into B1, B2. So in B1, basically the other concurrent driver mutation is HER2 gene mutation, either single nucleotide variants or small indel alterations in HER2 gene itself. You can see in here. And the B2 subgroup is basically is HER2 amplification concurrent with other receptor tyrosine kinase gene mutation, as shown here. And so in B2 subgroup, also I want to mention that in this group of patients, some of them actually developed the HER2 amplification after being treated with that other tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's kind of like a tumor progression. When it progressed, it developed HER2 amplification. So in this group of patients, have some of them have that kind of clinical presentation. So you can see in here, I thought it's also interesting. So different subgroups correlate with different HER2 immunostains. As you can see, for group A, so gray box meaning no HER2 IC was done. So in group A, almost all of them are scored as positive score, except with one is negative by HER2 IC, because in this one, there's a deletion mutation in the HER2 gene. That's why resulting in negative for HER2 immunostains. Whereas in this group, very interesting, in B1 group, actually most of them showing a negative HER2 IC result. And they found out actually the mutation is in the tyrosine kinase kinase domain. So when the HER2 gene gain this kind of a point mutation, it actually making not much HER2 gene expression on the cell membrane, so that you cannot detect it by using a HER2 IHC. So that offers that explanation why sometimes you offer patient with HER2 specific antibody, patient have a poor prognosis. Maybe they are in this group. That is probably why. And in the B2 group also, they showing all of them have a positive HER2 IHC. So I think that is interesting correlation there. Then I think, so in here, it's also demonstrate the HER2 amplification. Not only you can observe that in lung adenocarcinoma, but you can also see in squamous cell carcinoma, pleomorphic carcinoma, anosquamous carcinoma, and even thoracic SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumor. You can all observe HER2 amplification. So, and also they did all these experiments in the lab, but I think it's also very exciting to see. So in here, they have two cell lines. One cell line is lung adenocarcinoma. Another cell line is lung squamous cell carcinoma. You can see both cell line has really high copy of HER2 amplification. And also true when you do HER2 IC. And when these two cell lines being treated by the drugs, so this particular drug is a small molecule PAN ERBB tyrosine kinase. So for both cell lines, they show increased caspase 3/7. This is a death-related protein. So meaning treating within this drug showing more death in the tumor cells. Same thing is true when you're using the HER2 antibody drug conjugates, even showing more better effect. And here also showing similar thing. So if they use the EGFR targeted therapy using this drug erlotinib, it does not do anything for both cell lines. But when you use the HER2 specific therapy, it's showing reduced viability of the tumor cells. And also in here, I forgot to say that for both cell lines, they are in the group A genetic phenotype. For both cell lines. And then also they did the same kind of like same experiment. They also did a xenograft, meaning they inject those cell lines into mice and give the mice this drug, 10 milligram, give this regimen of drug to the mice, and they also see good response. You can see the tumor volume has been more reduced when you treat it with the specific therapy. And this one is a cell line derived from the patient's lung adenocarcinoma, and they also did the same xenograft experiment on mice, and you can also see that the HER2 antibody drug conjugates also showing pretty robust effect in reducing tumor volume in this figure. They also show the interesting treatment for a particular patient in here. So this is a patient who had RET gene fusion, has been treated with a specific target therapy and failed. After a failed therapy, when they analyzed the tumor again using NGS analysis, they found that the patient later developed HER2 amplification. So in the later stage, they treat the patient with a combined therapy, both RET fusion specific target therapy plus a target therapy to the HER2 amplification using the antibody drug conjugate therapy. And you can see that in 3 months, they say there's 33% reduction of the metastasis in the liver, showing in this figure. So I think overall, I just think this is a really a beautiful paper in showing that knowing more about the biology can tailor the therapies. For example, I mean, they identify this group of HER2 alterations. Even though you can detect amplification by either FISH or NGS, but this group of patients, they actually won't have good HER2 expression on the cells. So if using the conventional HER2 targeted therapy, like the HER2-specific antibody, it won't show good effect. However, even though they don't show good HER2 expression on the cell membrane, if you're using the HER2 antibody drug conjugate, they still seem to have efficiency. So I just think the HER2 antibody drug conjugates is more potent, more effective for a therapy than the other HER2 targeted therapies. So it's a rare event in non-small cell carcinoma. Only 0.9% of non-small cell carcinoma showing HER2 amplification. But I think if we can find this small group of patients, it can be very helpful using that particular therapy. Any questions?
I had a question. I'm just curious, in everybody's practices, have people been asking for HER2 IHC, and have you been doing these? And if so, like, what grading system are you using? Because I know we've had some, like, drug reps, reaching out and talking about this and saying that it's, something that we should be keeping on our radar, but we're not routinely doing it. And if we are, how would we grade it? Would we use breast or GI? I'm just curious about other people's experiences.
So I'm not in our IHC team, so maybe Jeff can talk about more because he's in the.
I haven't seen any of these requests, but this was talked about some at the Pulmonary Path Society meeting. In fact, Lynette presented some of the data from this paper, and they use the GI scoring system. So you use the same one you use for esophagus. It's not the breast system. It's the one summarized here on this page. But we're not doing it here. At least if we are, I don't know who's doing it, because the thoracic team isn't. And the IHC team isn't.
Yeah, no, I was there too. It was a good talk. Yeah, because we're not getting requests either, but I think this is going to be coming down the pipeline for all of us.
I think that's from a study called DESTINY study. That study basically saying that all comers, no matter which kind of cancers, you can use this scheme to score the HER2 expression by IHC, and there's no FISH involved. Basically, if you score two and three plus, patient is labeled as positive and can receive HER2 antibody drug conjugate, which seems to be more potent therapy than the other conventional HER2 targeted antibody therapy.
So
But
our
I think the
oncologist.
summary from, oh, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say it will. I think it's going to start. We're starting to see it here. So our oncologist have told us that they wanted us to be ready to get this going because they're going to start doing requests. And I think we saw a couple trickle in. So I think we'll be seeing more.
Can I ask MC, are they asking you to do that reflexively on all cancers, or just on those with advanced stage disease? How are you selecting? Do you know?
Right. Right now, we're not doing any reflex testing as of now. So right now, it's just when they order it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just got one last week. I have a question for like a biology point of view. You said there are many other driver mutations. So I'm just wondering how the HER2 therapy can be so effective if there are other things that are driving the cancer. So was that like a monotherapy or combined therapy with other things or even chemo is I mean, I didn't read the paper, but
Yeah, so yeah, I think that's a great question. So in here, basically, we're talking about the B2 group of tumors, right? So in here, some of them actually is patient already know have this tyrosine kinase receptor mutation has been treated with TKI, and they fail their treatment. Then they do NGS again on the progressed tumor, and they found the tumor initially does not have HER2 amplification, but later through a progression of disease, again, the HER2 amplification. So they showed an example that they treated with a TKI specific drug plus drug specific for HER2 amplification, like shown here. This is a patient that they present. So this patient does not have HER2 amplification to begin with, but once the disease progresses, again, the HER2 amplification. So they say that later on, when the patient gained the HER2 amplification, they can use a combined therapy targeting not only at RET fusion, but also targeted at HER2 amplification. But
I
if the
see.
patient start with both HER2 amplification and other driver gene mutation, I don't know which would be the best therapy to begin with. I don't think I extracted that data from the paper.
So I guess, all the targeted therapies, eventually the patient develops some other mutation or
Yes.
amplification. So it may be additional ammunition when that occurs, I guess.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. I think so. Yeah. I think I'm pretty much running out of time, but the last paper, I guess, it just can be really quickly. Basically, just saying using AI can help us to analyze neoadjuvant therapy, the pathological response, because it's a very painful process, as you know, right, to assess how much pathological response in neoadjuvant treated tumor. So in here, this paper just proposed that AI can do as good as a job as a pathologist. So basically, use the data from lung cancer clinical trial, LCMC3, from that clinical trial, they extrapolate data. Because in that clinical trial, you already have all the pathological response from the local pathologist and the central pathologist who review the cases. So you have four pathologists reading the pathological response. So that will be the going in information. Then they ask the AI, they develop some like an AI algorithm to using AI to analyze a pathological response. Then they compare, and the AI does a good job, as good as a human can do. There's some discrepancies, but kind of like small discrepancies between AI and the pathologist. So in here, this paper, this figure just showing that the local pathologist is doing as good as a job as a central pathologist. As you can see in here, the discrepancy is really just limited to like 7%, 8%, that the difference between local and central pathologist. And in here is showing that the pathology, they also concur in most of the events, like only 8 cases, 10 cases, the AI algorithm disagree with the pathologist. So overall, I think AI is doing a good job in analyzing a therapy-related response after neoadjuvant therapy. So I think this is very welcoming because I have done that kind of like pathologic response using the Excel file. It's really tedious and time-consuming. I really welcome this kind of like AI too to do this kind of analysis. I'm running out of time, but if you have more questions, can feel free to email me.
Thank you, Tao.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you,
you. A lot of papers.
Yes.
Thank you.